I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The court concludes prima facie that South Africa has standing to submit to it the dispute with Israel concerning alleged violations of obligations under the Genocide Convention.
In a landmark ruling, the International Court of Justice finds a plausible risk that Israel's committing genocide in Gaza and orders provisional measures, but stops short of calling for an immediate ceasefire. We'll play excerpts and get response. Then, to the uncle of a Palestinian-American teenager who was just shot dead in the West Bank last week. His family is calling for a transparent investigation. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The International Court of Justice has ordered Israel to take all measures within its power to prevent genocide in Gaza. The highly anticipated ruling of the World Court got underway shortly before we went on air. This is Joan Donahue, president of the International Court of Justice.
The court considers that the plausible rights in question in this proceeding, namely the right of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip to be protected from acts of genocide and related prohibited acts identified in Article 3 of the Genocide Convention, and the right of South Africa to seek Israel's compliance with the latter's obligation under the convention, are of such a nature that prejudice to them is capable of causing irreparable harm.
The ICJ started by ruling it has jurisdiction over the case brought by South Africa and dismissed Israel's bid to throw it out. The court, however, did not order an immediate ceasefire. The interim verdict is a major blow to Israel and the United States, which have undermined the case despite overwhelming evidence presented by South Africa. The court will not rule today on whether Israel has committed genocide. That verdict could take years. We'll have more on the historic ruling after headlines. Meanwhile, Israel's unrelenting assault on Gaza continues as the death toll tops 26,000, with at least another 65,000 injured. Over 11,000 of those killed are children. Khan Yunis, once designated as the so-called safe zone, remains under intense attack, with Israeli shelling and snipers reportedly targeting the Nasser and Al-Amal hospitals. Hundreds of families have fled the area in recent days after Israeli forces surrounded the southern city. World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who struggled to speak after becoming emotional, appealed for an immediate ceasefire.
70% of the dead are children and women. That alone is enough for a ceasefire. Because the bulk of the casualty, you know where it is. So I think this thing has to be taken seriously. And going forward, by the way, the number of deaths will increase, not only due to injuries, but chronically ill people, for instance.
Meanwhile, CIA Director William Burns will reportedly travel to France this weekend for a fourth round of talks aimed at reaching a halt in the fighting and a release of the remaining hostages in Gaza. The talks involve officials from the United States, Israel, Qatar, and Egypt. This comes as tensions mount between Israel and Qatar after leaked audio surfaced of Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu calling Qatar problematic as he met with family members of hostages. Doha slammed the remarks as, quote, obstructing and undermining the mediation process. Two more U.S. cities on Thursday passed resolutions for a ceasefire in Gaza. Minneapolis's resolution, approved in a 9-3 vote, also called for an end to U.S. military funding for Israel. Meanwhile, Somerville became the first Massachusetts city to pass a ceasefire resolution after months of constituent organizing. Cambridge, which is home to Harvard, is expected to pass their own ceasefire resolution on Monday. The United States and Iraq will start talks on phasing out the U.S.-led military coalition in Iraq. The U.S. has more than 2,500 troops in Iraq that initially returned to Iraq in 2014 to combat Islamic State fighters. U.S. bases have since come under attack by Iran-affiliated groups, which have increased in light of the U.S. backing of Israel's assault on Gaza. In Alabama, prison officials ended the life of 58-year-old Kenneth Smith via nitrogen gas asphyxiation in the nation's first-of-its-kind execution. In his final statement, Smith said, quote, "Tonight, Alabama causes humanity to take a step backwards. I'm leaving with love, peace, and light," he said. The case has garnered international condemnation. Kenneth Smith's spiritual advisor, Jeff Hood, witnessed the execution and rebuked Alabama's attorney general, who'd predicted Smith would lose consciousness within seconds and die within minutes. This is Jeff Hood.
"What we saw was minutes of someone struggling for their life. We saw minutes of someone heaving back and forth. We saw spit. We saw all sorts of stuff from his mouth develop on the mask. We saw this mask tied to the gurney and him ripping his head forward over and over and over again. And we also saw correction officials in the room who were visibly surprised at how bad this thing went."
A federal judge sentenced former Trump advisor Peter Navarro to 4 months in prison Thursday for contempt of Congress after he defied a subpoena from the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. Judge Amit Mehta told Navarro that citing executive privilege is not a, quote, "magical incantation or get-out-of-jail-free card." In other Trump news, closing arguments are being delivered today in a second defamation trial brought by writer E. Jean Carroll. This trial will determine whether Trump owes Carroll more damages on top of the $5 million a jury awarded her last year after finding Trump sexually abused her in the 1990s and later defamed her. A new study has found tens of thousands of pregnancies have resulted from rape in states where abortion was banned following the overturning of Roe v. Wade in 2022. Over the past 18 months, researchers estimate there were nearly 65,000 pregnancies from sexual assaults, with most, if not all, survivors, including girls, forced to carry them to term. Texas topped the list with 45% of the rape-related pregnancies. In Michigan, a first-of-its-kind manslaughter trial is underway for Jennifer Crumbly. The mother of the Oxford High School shooter, Ethan Crumbly, was just 15 years old when he opened fire on the school in 2021, killing four students and injuring six other people. His father, James Crumbly, is being tried separately later this year. This is Prosecutor Mark Keese delivering his opening statement.
"The evidence will prove that by the time this gun was bought, the school shooter was in a downward spiral that had begun months before. The evidence will also show you that Jennifer Crumbly was aware of that. Despite her knowledge of his deteriorating mental crisis, despite her knowledge of his growing social isolation, despite the fact that it is illegal for a 15-year-old to walk into a gun store and walk out with a handgun by himself, this gun was gifted."
France's top court ruled large parts of a new, highly contested immigration bill are unconstitutional. The court threw out nearly half the 80 measures in the legislation, including restrictions on access to welfare benefits for non-citizens and the denial of citizenship for children born in France. Immigrant rights activists and their allies took to the streets to welcome the move and vowed to keep fighting.
We are asking to be equal with others. We are simple, and it's simple what we're asking for. We want residency. We want to live with dignity in this country. The French are leaving here. They're going to our countries. We want freedom. That's it. Freedom, equality, fraternity.
In Australia, thousands of people rallied in Indigenous-led protests on so-called Australia Day, marking the arrival of European colonizers in 1788. January 26 has been dubbed Invasion Day by Aboriginal communities and their allies, who are pushing to do away with the national holiday. This is Aboriginal elder Adrian Buruguba.
We're here to tell people that Australia Day doesn't mean anything to us. It's the day of Aboriginal sovereignty. That day when they came here, we have to keep telling people that we were operating under our law and we still operate under our laws. And the law is in the land.
And here in New York, a memorial service for National Security Advisor and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger was met with protests Thursday. Activists chanted, "Burn, Henry, burn," as they remembered the 4 million people Kissinger's actions have killed across the globe.
We mourn the millions he killed. We mourn those in Cambodia, in Vietnam, in Laos, in Bangladesh, in East Timor, in Chile, in Argentina, in Cyprus, in Iraq, in Palestine, and in Angola. As we mourn the dead, we also honor those who fight to live. The litany of resistance groups that have stood up to Kissinger's imperialism outlive Henry Kissinger.
Activists held up signs that said Henry Kissinger, war criminal. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a landmark ruling today, the International Court of Justice found plausible risk that Israel's committing genocide in Gaza and ordered provisional measures, but stopped short of calling for an immediate ceasefire. The ruling was read out by the president of the court, Joan Donoghue. She began with the finding that South Africa had jurisdiction to bring the case against Israel.
In the court's view, at least some of the acts and omissions alleged by South Africa to have been committed by Israel in Gaza appear to be capable of falling within the provisions of the convention. In light of the following, the court concludes that, prima facie, it has jurisdiction pursuant to Article 9 of the convention to entertain the case.
South Africa had asked the court as a matter of extreme urgency to impose emergency measures to protect Palestinians in Gaza. The president of the court went on to read out the findings regarding South Africa's request for provisional measures.
In the court's view, the aforementioned facts and circumstances are sufficient to conclude that at least some of the rights claimed by South Africa and for which it is seeking protection are plausible. This is the case with respect to the right of Palestinians in Gaza to be protected from acts of genocide and related prohibited acts identified in Article 3, and the right of South Africa to seek Israel's compliance with the latter's obligations under the convention. The court then turns to the condition of the link between the plausible rights claimed by South Africa and the provisional measures requested. It considers that by their very nature, at least some of the provisional measures sought by South Africa are aimed at preserving the plausible rights it asserts on the basis of the Genocide Convention in the present case, namely, the right of the Palestinians in Gaza to be protected from acts of genocide and related prohibited acts mentioned in Article 3, and the right of South Africa to seek Israel's compliance with the latter's obligations under the convention. Therefore, a link exists between the rights claimed by South Africa that the court has found to be plausible and at least some of the provisional measures requested.
The president of the court, Joan Donoghue, cited the killing of Palestinians in Gaza, mass displacement, deprivation of aid and other charges brought by South Africa, and went on to say the court found a plausible risk that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza.
The court considers that there is urgency in the sense that there is a real and imminent risk that irreparable prejudice will be caused to the rights found by the court to be plausible before it gives its final decision. The court concludes on the basis of the aforementioned considerations that the conditions required by its statute for it to indicate provisional measures are met. It is therefore necessary, pending its final decision, for the court to indicate certain measures in order to protect the rights claimed by South Africa that the court has found to be plausible.
For more, we're joined by three guests. We're going to begin in Haifa with Diana Bhutu, Palestinian human rights attorney, former advisor to the negotiating team of the Palestine Liberation Organization. In 2004, Diana Bhutu was part of the legal team that won the case before the International Court of Justice, which ruled Israel's separation wall in the West Bank is illegal under international law. Diana Bhutu, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you can respond to the court's ruling that was just released moments before we went to air.
This is an amazing ruling because it highlights everything that the South African team and, of course, Palestinians have been saying the entire time, which is that Israel is plausibly carrying out genocide. And so the fact that the court has indicated to Israel that they have to take measures to prevent genocide, to make sure that soldiers are doing the same, to prosecute those individuals who are inciting, including high government officials, and ensure that there is effective humanitarian aid is precisely what was sought by Palestinians. It's now up to the world to make sure that this court ruling is actually enacted.
But they did not call for an immediate ceasefire, as South Africa asked. The significance of this?
I think it's very difficult at this stage for the court to be at pushing for a ceasefire. But in the fact that they said, first and foremost, that Israel has to take all measures to prevent acts of genocide is enough for the world to then be pushing for a ceasefire. It's really up to the international system, as we know it, to make sure that genocide is not carried out. And so it's important, it's imperative that this be followed up by countries around the world, making sure that Israel doesn't get to do whatever it wants to do with Palestinians in Gaza and continue this genocide.
And can you talk about the woman who we heard delivering the pronouncement of the court, Joan Donahue, former State Department official, though she's not representing the United States in this, she represents the court. She was in the State Department under President Obama.
Well, yes, and she was one of the judges, one of 17 judges on the bench. Two of them are ad hoc. One of the 15 permanent judges who ruled in favor of all of the measures that had been sought. Her term actually expires on February the 6th. And so she won't be with the court after that. But it was very important that this decision not just be a split court, but you can tell by the breadth of it that of the 17 judges, two being ad hoc, that on most of the issues, it was 15 versus two, one being the Ugandan judge and the second, of course, being the Israeli judge. And in some cases, it being 16 to one, with the one, ironically, being the Ugandan judge.
Why the Ugandan judge?
It's not clear. It's not entirely clear why. It's clear why the Israeli judge, obviously. But what's more important is the fact that we see that this court has overwhelmingly decided in favor of South Africa, has overwhelmingly determined that there is plausible risk of genocide. And it becomes imperative upon the world community to now act. You know, the fact that it's taken 112 days for the world to finally recognize that this is genocide and that it had to go to court says something about the international legal system as we know it, which is that it's broken. But I'm hoping that based on this, the world will now begin to act. And rather than hiding behind all of these false claims that Israel has repeated for the past 112 days.
I want to bring Roz Siegel into this discussion, Israeli historian, associate professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Stockton University, endowed professor in the study of modern genocide, co-authored a recent piece for Al Jazeera headlined Intent in the Genocide Case Against Israel is Not Hard to Prove. He's joining us from Philadelphia. Professor, welcome back to Democracy Now. Your response to this ruling.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you for having me. I think this is really an unprecedented ruling. It signals, first and foremost, the end of Israeli impunity in the international legal system, which is huge, right? Israel has enjoyed impunity in the international legal system for decades in the face of mounting evidence of gross violations of international law, mass violence, occupation, siege, so on. This is the end of that era. So it's just the beginning of a process that it really, I think now, with a ruling that basically recognizes the plausibility of genocide, the fact that Israel is likely committing genocidal acts, this is the beginning of a process of isolating Israel, because any university, company, state now will have to consider moving forward, whether it continues or doesn't continue in many cases, I think, to engage with Israel, because it is likely committing genocide. This also legally triggers third state's responsibility on issues of prevention and complicity with genocide. And this is significantly important today, where in a few hours in a court in Florida, there will be the hearing in the case that the Center for Constitutional Rights has brought against Biden, Blinken, and Austin, indeed, on complicity with genocide, U.S. complicity with genocide and the failure to prevent genocide. So this might have actually a certain effect even on this case today in California and moving forward. So this is really unprecedented. Yes, it is a disappointment that the court did not order an immediate ceasefire, but it did order Israel to cease from any genocidal acts, which de facto is actually an order for ceasefire.
And what about the issue of getting aid into Gaza, Roz Siegel?
Yeah, the court also issued an order on the urgent need, and it stressed, of course, the really unprecedented scale of destruction and killing, the dire situation in Gaza in terms of what we know, the levels of hunger and the spread of infectious disease. So it also ordered this, which is, again, very, very important. I mean, we all need to now wait and see what Israel's response to this will be.
I want to also bring into this discussion Mahmoud Mamdani, professor of government at Columbia University, who specializes in the study of colonialism. One of his many books is Neither Settler Nor Native, The Making and Unmaking of Permanent Minorities. He was previously a professor and director of the Center for African Studies at the University of Cape Town in South Africa, and has been an academic leader in Uganda for years. Professor Mamdani, your response to this ruling. We discussed yesterday, before the ruling, what you expected. What did you see today?
Thank you for bringing me in. Actually, everything that I expected happened. I wasn't sure they would call for a ceasefire. But now, listening to the reasoning of the court, it is clear to me that they couldn't have called directly for a ceasefire without preempting their future deliberations. At the same time, if it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, and sounds like a duck, then it's a duck. Everything they ordered in terms of preventive measures leads to only one conclusion, which is ceasefire. How do you stop killing people? Ceasefire. How do you ensure that supplies for human life get in? Ceasefire. And so on and so forth. I think the ball is now in the political domain. The law cannot displace politics. It can open avenues for politics. And that's where we are now. This ruling is enormously significant in terms of broadening the avenues for politics, in terms of strengthening and accelerating the trend towards a global alliance against settler colonialism, and it has the U.S. on the defensive, Israel on the defensive. We know that the last time the court ruled against Israel, which was the on the question of the wall, Israel just ignored it. But this time, I think it may not be so easy to do. First of all, one has to ask oneself, why did Israel come before the court? It could have just ignored it, according to its past conduct. That's what it would have done. So the fact that it came before the court suggests that there are conflicting pressures before the Israeli government. Now, what does it do? I think this is one goal in favor of the world, and we continue with the game.
And your insight into the Ugandan judge of the International Court of Justice. Sometimes the vote was 15-2, as Diana Butu said, the Ugandan judge and the Israeli judge, and sometimes it was 16-1.
Well, Judge Sebutimbe, she had a career where she had opposed the Museveni regime on several legal issues in court. Then she was appointed by the Museveni regime on the international stage, thus removing her from the local stage. I haven't followed her career since then, but she was pretty consistent. There seemed to be no indication that she was making up her mind from issue to issue. I can't say anything more than that right now.
Well, we're going to go to break and then come back to our guests. We're speaking with Columbia University professor Mahmoud Mamdani here in New York, with Roz Siegel, the Israeli historian and professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Stockton University, and in Haifa, Diana Butu, Palestinian human rights attorney. We'll also hear more from the International Court of Justice, the UN's highest court. Stay with us.
You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes. And I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you set by
Masters of War, Bob Dylan, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. The International Court of Justice, the UN's highest court, has found a plausible risk Israel's committing genocide in Gaza and ordered provisional measures, but stopped short of calling for an immediate ceasefire. This is the president of the court, Joan Donahue, reading out the vote of part of the ruling.
By 15 votes to 2, the State of Israel shall, in accordance with its obligations under the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide in relation to the Palestinians in Gaza, take all measures within its power to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of Article 2 of the Convention, in particular, A, killing members of the group, B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and D, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group.
Over a one-hour ruling, the International Court of Justice President Joan Donahue in The Hague quoted Israel's defense minister, Yoav Gallant, saying that as the war got underway, Gallant had said, "We have removed all restrictions